Have you opened your mouth if you would as well? And say big ah, big ah. Okay, and go ahead and flip your tongue up as well. Great.
We're in an examining room at the J-Docs Free Health Clinic in Kansas City, Kansas. It's staffed by KU Med students. A gray-haired woman in a blue hoodie sits on an examination table. Meanwhile, the aspiring doctor's fingers scurry across a laptop keyboard as she talks.
Okay. Yeah, I'm seeing a lot of irritation back there, a lot of redness, and I would even say a little bit of white spotting back there as well.
For residents of Wyandotte County, insurance isn't quite the obstacle it used to be when it comes to health care access, thanks to the Affordable Care Act. But a growing problem is a lack of a truly robust network of health care providers. It's a challenge to get aspiring doctors like the one treating this patient to pursue work as primary care physicians, and to do so in underserved communities. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR's Central Standard, we'll find out how the situation affecting both patients and doctors. Have you struggled to find a healthcare provider, someone who can address your specific needs right there in your own community within a reasonable distance from where you live and work? Or have you found the resources you need? 816-235-2888. Tell us what community you live in and how a shortage of healthcare providers has affected you. Now I'd like to introduce Anne-Marie Marciarelli to the show. She's a professor of health law at UMKC. Hi, Anne-Marie.
Hello.
We're also joined by a family physician at St. Luke's South Primary Care, Dr. Michael Munger. Good morning. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. My pleasure.
Listeners to Morning Edition probably heard Alex Smith's story on the shortage of providers in Wyandotte County. That's part of a Crossing to Health series airing this week, exploring disparities between the side-by-side communities of Wyandotte and Johnson counties. But in case anyone missed it, Anne-Marie, how would you describe the situation with primary care providers right now in general?
Well, I would say that nationwide, we have had a little building boom in terms of medical schools, new medical schools opening and new medical schools in the pipeline. So if we wanted to refer to supply as production, I'd say production is somewhat up. But as you pointed out in the introduction, demand is up as well. And then here's the tricky third part, which is, so where the doctors are and the specialties that they practice in doesn't always map well onto where the need is and what the specialty areas people are seeking. So I think we have both problems of supply, but maybe also problems of, how should we put it, allocation or fit?
Yeah, mapping was a nice word. I mean, what would you say is going on in underserved communities like Wyandotte County in particular?
Well, I would say that, so Wyandotte is an interesting example of a problem that's writ large elsewhere, where we have an aging population. And of course, we all age into further health complications. So far, as I often point out to people, that's how it works, okay? And so people's needs get more complex and more intense. So you would think then that maybe we need to have more providers in certain areas, particularly primary care providers, who are the great first-level providers and also increasingly the traffic directors for other kinds of care in our healthcare system. And what's happening is that overall, fewer medical students are attracted to primary care. And that's, if you think about it, perhaps the inverse of what it needs to be.
Can you, the story people might have heard this morning explains it, but can you summarize some of the reasons why people aren't going into primary care like they used to?
There are a lot of reasons. Like most complicated problems, that's actually a complicated answer. But I would say part of it has to do with the way we train and develop future providers. We have a very distinguished and admired by the rest of the world, but also somewhat tradition-ridden way of producing new, for instance, doctors. And one of them is that we train them in hospitals. We focus on the kinds of things that aren't primary care. Good primary care, of course, is community-based most often. So we train young, malleable, you know, impressionable students to think that important, interesting, valuable, intellectually challenging things happen, for instance, in a hospital, not in the community. So there's a kind of a perspective problem. There's also a financial problem, a reimbursement to be the kind of provider who is a community-based primary care provider, particularly in underserved communities, is not the most lucrative of the specialties, and our system is organized so that medical students basically get to pick their own specialty as long as they meet the qualifications. So you could see in a system where we debt finance medical education and we expect the students to debt finance medical education, the incentive would be to move towards a specialty where you could pay off your medical education faster. I would say, so the kind of twin things of kind of outlook, perspective, how we develop people, and maybe what I'm going to call reimbursement, compensation. There are a lot of other things going on as well, but maybe lots of things cluster under those two categories.
How does the Affordable Care Act play into this whole dynamic between the demand for doctors and the supply of doctors and where they're located?
Well, there's no doubt about it. Okay, on a nationwide basis, if you move 17 million people who are formerly in uninsured status into insured status, that demand will increase. Okay, there's really, people will tell you 8 ways to Sunday, all kinds of other things, but your visceral reaction on that is correct. So yes. Now, in states that haven't expanded Medicaid, which is, of course, the government-funded health insurance program for lower-income people, that increase in the number of insured is not as dramatic, and neither Kansas nor Missouri has to date expanded Medicaid under the ACA. So we carry, in both of these states, we could say higher percentages of adult uninsured than would typically be found in other states in the United States. But even still, more people moving into insured status through subsidized purchases through the exchange means demand goes up, and demand has risen. And of course, where everyone starts, who previously maybe not had very good or any access to healthcare, is of course where they should start, with a primary care provider, which, as we know from your introduction, is a bit of the bottleneck.
Michael Munger, as a primary care physician yourself, how would you describe the role of primary care providers in the big health care picture? Are you guys like the first line of defense?
We're not only the first line of defense, but if you will, you could also consider us the quarterback.
It's not a real big football person. You might have to explain it.
Well, it's in addition to taking care of the needs of individuals when they come into the office as the first line. Also part of the role of the primary care physician is to act as that coordinator to help make sure that those individuals, when they need extra care or specialty care, they get directed to the proper place at the proper time.
I personally think of my primary care physician as the doctor I have a relationship with, like a long-term relationship where I don't just show up one day with a problem in a big file, which makes a difference to me in terms of my comfort and trust levels, just to have someone who goes through my health experiences with me like this, you know, and probably in his ability to notice when something seems off. Is there a significance there?
Absolutely. You just basically hit one of the core principles of primary care and especially family medicine. That is that continuous ongoing relationship, not only with the patient, but with families. Having practiced for 29 years, I now am proud to say I'm taking care of 4 generations in some families. And so you are that trusted individual. You're the one that, quite honestly, as you develop that relationship, you get the invites to weddings and baptisms and anniversaries and all those other things. You become part of the family.
What do you think a community, I mean, beyond just what an individual loses without a primary care physician, what do you think a community loses without enough of you?
The community loses access to that ongoing and continuous relationship. It has been one of the challenges as we have more individuals that have insurance now, as we have the aging population, as patient panels grow, primary care physicians in many cases are actually closing their practice. And so patients actually lose access to that core fundamental ability to achieve the care. We know in other countries who have overall high quality, good health of the population, one of the hallmarks of those healthcare delivery systems is the size of the primary care workforce, usually closer to around 50%, whereas in this country we're closer to around 30% of our overall physician workforce is primary care.
Anne Marie, do you want to chime in on this?
Well, I do think that that last statistic, Dr. Munger, is very telling, that in fact we as a society have invested more in specialty care than in primary care. and we reap the whirlwind, as it were, which makes it harder for people to get actually what everyone needs, which is through the front door to primary care. And then some people need to proceed on from there. We defeat attempts at healthcare reform and cost control in this way as well, because we drive people to much higher cost venues for care when we make primary care difficult or inaccessible.
How does someone end up with a specialist, with access to a specialist, without having first gone to a primary care physician? I mean, if someone has a heart problem, do they just go straight to a cardiologist, or are they just not ending up in the cardiologist's office at all because they haven't gone through what you're calling the front door, Anne Marie?
Well, the way referrals work differs upon who the source of your health insurance is, or whether indeed you have health insurance. So the way I often describe it is that we don't have a healthcare system in our country, we have healthcare systems. So if I could use my typical cardiac patient, if I might, a Medicare-enrolled individual, that's an older individual typically, although some working disabled people are enrolled in Medicare. Medicare, which is a completely 100% federally funded, a government-funded insurance for individuals, allows self-referral. And so you can see by allowing that, and also by arguably making it more difficult to access primary care, you could see how people might be referring themselves all over the place for things that actually might not need escalation at that point. But we push people, I think is the way to put it. The way we've organized things pushes people sometimes to not get the good counsel and wise counsel about step approaches and watchful waiting that they would get from a primary care provider by making it hard to have that conversation.
Is there, I mean, that's one scenario where someone through self-referral is putting him or herself in a specialist's office. Is there also the possibility that that person is just sitting at home worrying? Anne Marie?
Yes. I think a certain number of people, Americans have varying degrees of what I'm going to call insurance intelligence, by which I mean we don't teach it in high school. So most of what people learn, they learn from word of mouth, or they call me, or or they pick up urban legends on the internet or whatever. They don't really understand typically their health insurance policy, to be perfectly candid. And I find this incidentally at all educational levels and at all income levels. Because our insurance system is so complex, and that is of course a choice, but I do not mean to insult anyone by saying this, but I think it should be known that our intelligence quotient on insurance is woefully low. And many people are so scared of exposure, if they were to self-refer to a specialist, quite rightly.
What do you mean afraid of exposure?
Afraid of financial exposure.
Gotcha.
Many commercial insurance policies, sometimes called private insurance, set some hoops you have to jump through, gatekeeping functions, in order to have such a referral. And people are aware that these exist, although they often don't understand how they work in their particular plan or what they're supposed to do, or what I call insurance intelligence. But people freeze when they don't know what to do. There's a lot of good data on how our minds work. And there are a fair number of people who freeze with any kind of, not just cardiac, any kind of condition, because the easy alternative is not apparent.
Dr. Munger, is this something that you encounter when you talk through patients' problems with them?
Absolutely. I mean, as we've seen, as we're moving forward, as more patients are getting and I've actually seen kind of the flip side of that, of more patients are getting insured. They're coming in with very high deductible plans. We take care of everything we can. But there are times when I may suggest, gee, I think you need this given service, be it a screening colonoscopy, although that may not be the perfect example, or you may need to see a consultant, be it a cardiologist. Sometimes the patients will look at me and say, well, wait a minute, I don't think I can afford that. I have a high deductible plan.
Does it matter? I mean, when we talked about access to primary care physicians, and I think we're getting a pretty good understanding of why that matters, but does it matter where a doctor is located? I mean, technically, why couldn't people in one county just visit a doctor somewhere else? What's the issue there?
It's access to the care. And again, it depends on the panel sizes of the physicians. Most patients want to be somewhat close to where their healthcare needs are, especially depending on what, if they come up with an acute illness, you may not want to travel 40 miles to go see a primary care physician. So it really is important that you have those services in the neighborhood, in the community.
Anne Marie, are there other reasons why location matters?
I think that was a very good observation Dr. Munger just made, but also the idea that primary care, what's the goal? The goal is to have what? Improved quality of life, right? And to have improved health outcomes. Works best, the data tells us, the closer it is to the ground. Now, specialty care, it may well be that people have to travel. We're all aware, for instance, that if, God forbid, you needed an organ transplant, you would have to travel for that from many locations in the state of Missouri. But primary care works, especially in its preventative mode and its treatment of controlling chronic illness, the closer it is to the ground. So we defeat it if we treat it as if it were just another form of specialty care. Heck, you'd travel, you know, several counties for an organ transplant. Wouldn't you do that to try and control your rheumatoid arthritis? Not at all the same thing.
So it seems like there are two issues. One is the fact that fewer and fewer medical students are choosing to go into primary care. And the other is that those who do are often not enticed, even with debt repayment incentives, to work in underserved communities. Let's look at the primary care issue. How is that overall lack of primary care providers affecting patients, broadly speaking, Anne Marie? I mean, do you have numbers and things like that?
Some good data, not great data. In fact, I'd like to make the pitch for better data, okay, looking at both Missouri and Kansas, okay. But the federal government also tracks strictly numerically. It looks at provider supply and tries to estimate based on population demographics. Remember my rule of thumb that older people will need more, you know, healthcare interactions, more healthcare visits. Try to track what you might call shortage areas. But this is all sort of, how can I put it, kind of numerically driven. It's ratio driven. We don't have really good data in Missouri and Kansas, or not that I know of, where we actually track patients' response data. For instance, how difficult was it for you to get an appointment when you needed to, say your primary care provider died or retired and you absolutely needed to have a new primary care provider? How long did you have to wait? How long were you essentially without a primary care provider? Those kinds of questions. That data is collected in other states. I find it very illuminating and interesting. We don't, as far as I know, collect it systematically, partly because we can't agree on the data that we would collect, which is somewhat telling. But I think we can say that there's been some pretty good data done by, there's an organization called the Robert Graham Center based in DC, which looks at every state and makes some workforce projections. And they are projecting a pretty significant primary care physician need increase for Missouri. And they compare us to other states in the Midwest, and then they do a nationwide study. And the reality is that with an aging population, and we are disproportionately aging, we are not kept youthful like the United States, the rest, other parts of the United States are, through both immigration and then also through the large families that second and third generation immigrants have. From an aging population, we probably are going to experience a pretty significant divergence between what we have and what we're going to need if everything stays the same.
Right? Dr. Munger, I wonder how a lack of primary care providers is affecting you as a physician. Do you feel overwhelmed by the number of people who need the kind of care you provide?
Absolutely. And it's interesting that you would think after a certain length of time, you have your patient panel, it becomes established, and actually we're finding that there's more and more individuals needing access. And the reality is, for myself and many primary care physicians throughout the area, where do you put them? You know, you can be innovative with the way you schedule and try to have open access scheduling and same-day appointments, but when the demand outstrips what you can supply, it becomes a real issue.
How does that issue look, like, really specifically? I mean, I'm thinking about things like wanting to serve as many people as come to you with a need, and also wanting to have the time and energy to focus on each individual patient, things like that.
Absolutely. And, you know, you still, at the end of the day, if I'm going to have a continuous, ongoing good relationship with you, I have to be able to look you in the eye. I have to be able to spend time with you. I have to be able to talk to you and listen to you. And you can't just simply push more individuals through. It takes away from your experience. It may decrease the quality of care that can be delivered.
How else is this being felt on the patient side of things, whether we're talking about wait times to see providers or other nitty-gritty type details, the kinds of things that actually matter a whole lot in the course of a human being's chaotic life?
You know, one of the things that you really pay attention to if you do a patient satisfaction survey and you look at and you let the patients talk to you, you look at some of those key things like, did the patient feel like they were listened to? Did they feel like they were treated with respect? Did they feel like they were given ample time to discuss what they needed? You just cannot try to rush somebody through as much as you can.
KCUR Central Standard will be back in a minute. When we return, we'll be taking your calls at 816-235-2888. Tell us how access to primary care, or lack thereof, has affected your life and your health. 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. That's coming right up. And we're back. This is KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today's show is inspired by a reporting series exploring health disparities between Johnson County and its next-door neighbor, Wyandotte County. For more on that series, Crossing to Health, head to our website, kcur.org. Today's topic is access to primary care providers. There's a shortage everywhere, but it's most pronounced in underserved communities. We've been discussing that with Dr. Michael Munger, a family physician at St. Luke's South, and Anne-Marie Marciarelli, a professor of health law at UMKC. Anne-Marie, I want to talk to you about the idea of access, not to a single provider, but to a network of providers. Who, other than physicians, would ideally be part of that kind of network?
Well, there have been tweaks and attempts to develop new models of healthcare delivery, sometimes called accountable care organizations, sometimes called a medical home. And these are slightly different, but the similar idea, which is maybe we ought to develop a sort of cross-life, if I can put it, cross-venue, panels of providers that would serve a certain patient population. Let's take our classic Medicare, cardiac patient. Maybe someone who'd actually had a heart attack would not only have encounters with a physician, perhaps later with a cardiologist and maybe even a surgeon, but would also have contact with a rehabilitation facility, with nutritional counseling, with lifestyle counseling, with an exercise person, with so the idea to kind of bring those people together in a group around a particular diagnosis and a set of needs is one that's actually been percolating for a while. I think the Affordable Care Act sort of added some incentives, some financial incentives to get more providers to, can I call it, collaborate in this way. So yes, there may be a time in the relatively near future where when you plug into a system for a particular diagnosis, a sort of panel of providers comes with it. It would be interesting to see, given our current shortage, who would fill the primary care role on such a panel for many people. But yes, people are thinking along these lines and experimenting with it.
Well, let's turn to one of our callers. We've got Deborah with us from Kansas City, Missouri. She called 816-235-2888. Hi, Deborah.
Hi. I just quickly want to give you a little of my background. I grew up in a small town for my first 20-plus years, and I still go back there very often. And I went to medical school for a year and a half, and my husband's a physician, so I've been involved with the medical profession for over 40 years. And I have a couple comments. One is on the personal relationship. I think you really have that if you're in a small enough practice, but a lot of practices, especially in the city, they use hospitalists.
Excuse me, could you repeat that last sentence? They use what?
Hospitalists. When you go into the hospital, you do not see your primary care physician or your internist or your pediatrician, which also really are primary levels of physicians.
So you're saying people are treating the hospital as their stand-in for primary care?
No, I'm saying when they go to their primary care physician and they have to go in the hospital or they see a specialist who puts them in the hospital, the primary care physician is not involved in your care, at least in the city. No.
Oh, okay, I get it. So are you saying that in smaller communities, the primary care physician follows you sort of through your process a little bit more?
Yes, definitely, unless they're a big regional medical center, which uses hospitalists. Also, having been in medical school and watched my husband go through medical school, I even felt this clear back then, that it's accurate to say that their training is geared toward more complicated things, which a primary care physician has to recognize, but they also get the standard things like standard OB, complicated OB too, and pediatrics, which may be more in the hospital more, but they have clinics that they go to when they see people at the basic level. But my feeling is that there is so much knowledge in the medical field that I think nurse practitioners, for most things, could be the first contact.
That's an interesting idea, Deborah. Let's get some response to that. Dr. Munger, what do you think about nurse practitioners and other professionals who are not physicians, technically speaking, who have maybe a role to play in this?
Absolutely, they do. Anna Marie had mentioned earlier about patient-centered medical home, which we're a part of in the St. Luke's Health System. We're recognized. One of the foundations there is around team-based care, leveraging an entire team to take care of your patient population, including nurse practitioners, physician assistants, registered nurses, even medical assistants. Nurse practitioners and physician assistants are critical members of the overall team and can certainly provide many of the primary care services.
Anne Marie, how does this work in other states? Is this a particular dynamic we have in Kansas and Missouri?
Well, we are complicated, okay? So the permissible scope of practice of, can I call them advanced practice nurses as an umbrella term, is of course a matter of state control. You could group the states into ones that are full practice that essentially allow practice and licensure for all nurse practitioners to do fairly higher order things. Reduced practice, what it sounds like, kind of a midpoint, and then restricted practice, the most narrowly defined categories of things that these licensed health professionals can do. And Missouri is in the restricted practice category. I believe Kansas is what I would say in that middle ground, reduced practice. What this means is that, so among those providers who might be willing to help out with primary care, they are constrained in what they can do, particularly what they can do independently and the kind of breadth and width of what they can do. And so if you think of them as, in part, possibly as a kind of release, a relief valve, okay, on this pressure building up in the primary care system, we won't open the valve, okay, as a state. Particularly in Missouri, we've made a decision not to relieve some of the pressure in this way, including these folks and teams, like at St. Luke's is wonderful, but in reality, in rural areas, they really need to have much more authority in order to make a dent in the great number of people, particularly in rural areas, who lack what we might argue reasonable access to primary care.
Dr. Munger, I want to pick up quickly on one other thing that our caller mentioned, which was this idea of a primary care physician having the ability to follow a patient through care they're receiving either from specialists or in hospitals. Do you feel like there are things that kind of prevent you from being able to do that, even just, yeah, time and capacity?
It's absolutely capacity. Myself, I followed my own patients in the hospital up until about 3 years ago and realized that the overwhelming demand was in the office and in the ambulatory setting, and it would be very important to follow a patient through a hospitalization, but the reality is you have patients who need access in the ambulatory setting, and that's one of the main reasons why most of primary care has gone to utilizing physicians, primary care physicians who specialize in hospital medicine to take care of those in the hospital.
When you say that it's important to provide that kind of care in the hospital setting, why is that important? I mean, what's the benefit there?
I know the patient, and I will probably know in many cases if they've gone through certain things in the past, if they've had past procedures that maybe aren't readily available in terms of information that is there. I also know the patient and the family, and I know their needs and their wants and what their goals are.
Let's talk to another caller. We've got Richard in Kansas City, Missouri on the line. Hi, Richard.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for the topic and the conversation. I've been fortunate enough to normally have good access to a care provider, but I have been, I guess, injured or damaged by what I think is a care provider not being able to pay close enough attention. I was one time in for a test, and my skin was burnt because a treatment was left on too long. It was because the doctor left the room and was seeing so many other patients. And that was a long time ago, and since then, virtually every time you go to a care provider, there it's almost like a race to get your to be able to talk to the person quickly enough before they interrupt you and then leave the room. And that's even, I think, with I like my doctor now, but he's in there for a few minutes and then he's got to go on to the next room. And I just wondered if your panel could talk about, you know, alternatives to that. I think we're all injured to a certain extent, or all denied primary care to a certain extent, because our doctors, I'm not necessarily blaming the doctors, but the system, insurance, whatever, forces those doctors in some cases, I think, to spend so little time with each patient, and maybe a lot of them would prefer that not be that way. Are there other systems out there? Is there? I've read about doctors that reject insurance altogether and just have pay for service, and they can sit and be with a patient for however long it takes. Could they comment about that?
Yeah, Anne Marie, why don't you respond to this caller's questions?
It's a great set of questions. It's kind of multi-layered. I'll address first the issue of what we would call abbreviated visits, which if you're old enough, Richard, I certainly am, have gotten increasingly abbreviated. Can we say that? Okay. yes, it is. It is, of course, driven by reimbursement. Okay. But it's also driven by the acknowledgement that every extra minute that you might spend with someone else is a minute, in a sense, taken from someone else. If you're having problems of spreading yourself, you know, among all the people you'd like to help, every minute comes at a cost to someone as well. It comes at a benefit to another person. But if there's a finite pie, and there appears to be in primary care at present, the equities are, they go both ways, okay? But I will say that there's a lot of data that shows that advanced practice nurses and physician's assistants are allowed to be, possibly because they're paid at a lower rate, more generous with their time. And then the patient satisfaction data, as a result, not surprisingly, is higher. People feel, well, I got listened to. You know, I got maybe a little bit more educated because it was a little more time for that as well. So I think these topics that we're circling around, after a while, they begin to kind of, we see the interlocking pieces, right? If physicians are spread too thin, maybe it shouldn't be a physician in every clinical encounter. Maybe it should be some other kind of primary care provider.
You know,
I think it's hard. I think everyone feels that pressure to put out their biggest symptom because guess what? Nobody's going to listen to four, you know.
Do underserved communities with a lot of low-income residents have particular needs that should be considered part of the healthcare equation? And I wonder if currently those things are seen as that, Anne-Marie.
Well, I'm glad we finally got to this because the shortage of primary care providers is not evenly, the experience of it is not evenly spread among the population. A lot depends on the kind of insurance that you cover when you're talking about accessing care in the clinic, okay, in the community. And that's because reimbursement rates vary greatly, okay, and therefore not a, you know, a provider is essentially running a business or a group of providers essentially running a business can't afford to take all low reimbursement rate patients unless they're subsidized in some other way. So they call this patient mix or payer mix. Okay, everyone has to kind of balance the books. What that means is that if you come with a relatively thin reimbursement, think a very modest health insurance plan or think government-funded health insurance like Medicaid, not Medicare, but Medicaid, yes, it's going to be the shortage or the difficulties of access are disproportionately going to land on you. Yes. And, you know, that's one of the, like, we don't all experience the shortage the same way, I guess.
Are there things that come up in just the lives of people in these communities that are not currently seen as part of someone's quote unquote healthcare in the eyes of the medical establishment? Anne-Marie?
Oh, well, I don't want to speak for providers, but I will say that I think primary care in particular has broadened its sense of what is a healthcare consideration. Some of this is driven by a public health approach. For instance, of course it matters if you are a small child or a baby and you live in a house where lead paint is exposed, right? I mean, everyone knows that now, right? Now you might argue, well, that's a commentary on the housing stock, but it's also a commentary on likely health outcomes for your family and cognitive and brain development for the child. So people care more about these things now and think more about these things and ask more about these things. So yes, I think the idea of what relates to health, sometimes called the social determinants of health, has broadened. And if you've taken a child to a pediatrician lately, you know this. You're asked about things that in the past were relevant, but maybe not, you know, discussed.
Let's hear from Dr. Munger on this.
Well, thank you. And I totally agree with Anne-Marie. Really, the emphasis in primary care now is really starting to look at that interface with public health, but also recognizing, as she mentioned, the social determinants, socioeconomic status, the ability for individuals to have access to good foods. There are food deserts in many of our areas where they just don't have access to fresh fruits and vegetables. Very definitely play an overall role in their health.
Michael Munger, stay with me through the break, okay?
You bet.
Anne-Marie Marciarelli, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you. My pleasure.
When we return, what does it mean to be healthy? Is it time to refresh our understanding of good health? That and more after this break. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Gina Kaufman. We've been talking about health disparities, but health is a term that encompasses so much, and people have lots of different understandings of what healthy living looks like. Is it more than that swimsuit body people are aiming for with their New Year's resolutions? Dr. Michael Munger of St. Luke's South Primary Care, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
We've also got a fitness guy in the room. Matt Scanlon is with us from CrossFit Memorial Hill Gym. Hi, Matt.
Hi, thanks for having me.
As a gym owner, you're interacting with people who are striving for what they think of as a healthy lifestyle all the time. Do you see interesting variations when it comes to how people think about healthiness?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I talk with people that are members of our gym that are looking for, you know, improved quality of life. And also, like you were saying, that swimsuit body, it varies wildly. There's people that want to be able to play with their grandkids, have fun, you know, access their environment in a really meaningful way. And then there's other people that are just, you know, running away from disease and sickness as well. So that range of people seeking what they perceive as a healthy lifestyle is vast.
How do you think of what it means to be healthy? I mean, what does it mean to you?
Yeah, so to me, there's kind of two components. I see it as a continuum. You know, Michael here can probably point to some very real bioindicators of health. For me, my history being in working in the long-term care community, I would see health as, I would define it as your ability to navigate your environment in as many ways as you would like for as long as possible. And that's a process. It changes. It's not a binary relationship with health. But I think it encompasses a lot of what people are looking for when they perceive health.
As we've kind of hit on, it's New Year's resolution season, and losing weight is a hugely popular goal. Is there a danger in seeing thinness as such a significant measure of what we think of as healthy, or is that actually a helpful measuring stick?
No, I wouldn't say at all. And actually, I would even back up a step and say that the outcome is dangerous. Like, having your goal be an outcome in a lifelong process. So we say that, you know, health is access to a myriad of different, you know, bioindicators and access to your environment, your ability to move, your ability to be happy. And this is something that we would prefer you do for the rest of your life, not just until you reach 10 pounds, which I think is probably
the idea is that then you're done.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's not the case.
Michael, what's your perspective as a physician?
I echo that entirely. This time of year when I'm hearing about this, I usually try to remind individuals it's really what they do between New Year's and Thanksgiving, not what they do between Thanksgiving and New Year's that's going to contribute to their overall health. I also am not one who really emphasizes diets. I mean, that is just simply a short-term calorie restriction to reach a goal. I want somebody to be living a healthy lifestyle.
So what does that mean to you?
It means that you have to have a level of physical activity, even more than what your body weight is. You need, our body is a machine. It needs to be worked, and we need to, on a daily basis, incorporate things within our current lifestyle that will get us up and moving, be active.
As we were discussing this idea around the office, someone suggested that as a culture, we have a better sense of what constitutes unhealth in the negative sense than we do of what health actually looks like in the positive.
Absolutely. I mean, there are so many things if you look at if you lead a healthy lifestyle, if you use moderation in terms of your intake of calories, if you use moderation in terms of intake of alcohol, if you do not smoke, or if you smoke, you stop, and if you're using physical activity on a regular basis, the positive impact to you down the road with your blood pressure, with your reducing your risk for diabetes, with your overall cholesterol numbers, your heart health, it just keeps going on and on.
Matt, do you find that people come into your gym with a list of things that they shouldn't do more than with a sense of, like, this is what healthy means?
100%. You know, my industry is to blame for a lot of feelings around people's health, and we try to fundamentally shift that. One thing that we talk about people when they first step in is bright spots. You know, we would say, what's going well right now? What do you love? What motivates you? Let's build upon that, instead of that conversation being, oh, I'd like to drop 2 pant sizes. Like, that will ultimately, your motivation towards dropping 2 pounds pant sizes will be done in about 6 to 8 weeks. You will not be motivated towards that anymore. You will be motivated to play with your kids, you know, well, and your grandkids well into your 60s and 70s. So we tried to really shift that conversation around the positive.
One of the upcoming stories in the Crossing to Health series is about drinking. How much do you think alcohol consumption does have to do with the person's overall health?
It has quite a bit to do. There is evidence out there that says a small amount of alcohol on a regular basis can actually be very healthy, can be heart healthy. But we're talking about one drink a day. If you get over 3 drinks a day on average, it has adverse effects in many of the organ systems. And so you try to emphasize to individuals, you know, one drink a day doesn't mean you drink nothing Sunday through Thursday and then, you know, drink 6 or 7 on Friday or Saturday. It doesn't work that way.
Why not?
just simply because the effects of binge drinking are as harmful as consistent high levels of drinking.
Do most people think about alcohol and other substances, whether we're talking about like caffeine or harder stuff, when they evaluate healthfulness? Or do we think of that as being part of our social life as opposed to maybe our physical well-being, our medical situation?
Most of the time it's considered as more of a social aspect of their life, and you really have to frame it for someone to say, no, this is part of your overall health.
How much do things, though, that fall outside of the technically medical realm contribute to what we think of as health? I mean, is it more than just the medical stats?
Oh, absolutely. You know, there are certain lifestyles that you really contribute to overall health that are important to bring to someone's awareness. Something as simple as, if you're trying to exercise and you're riding a bicycle, do you use a helmet? Do you buckle up every time you get in the car? I mean, just very basic things that do contribute to overall health.
What are some of the things that you've noticed, Matt, that are part of health but that we don't necessarily think of that way?
Yeah, absolutely. There's key elements of adopting this process of health, which is kind of the language that we try to use, as, you know, not having this end goal. And some of those things are, you know, demonstrable progress before these lagging indicators happen. So let's take the example of decreased body fat. There are a bunch of different things that will happen before you actually see your body fat decrease. So having a system whereby you're reinforcing success before these lagging indicators happen is a way that keeps people motivated while they're waiting to see these body composition changes, for example. That, in addition to social support, is another key aspect of maintaining this process of health.
That does raise the question. I mean, is good health achieved by individuals or communities? Do things like infrastructure, transportation, social networks, even economics play into our just personal health scenarios?
So when you look at the way that people access, let's just say fitness for an example. So we know that about 5% of people on their own volition without any sort of external motivation or consequences will access fitness facilities. So 5% of people are just accessing this on their own because you're feeling motivated. The other 95% of people need external motivation, and that can come in through consequences. Medical consequences can be a strong motivator. But then in addition to that, there are very strong social supports, community supports that are necessary for people to adopt. You know, what we're starting to see is more of a habit change than just one day I'm going to decide to be healthy. It's a very long and drawn out process.
And I also think right along with that, I think those are excellent points. It makes a difference in the community. Is there access to safe bicycle lanes and biking and hiking trails and walking trails? And do you have, as mentioned earlier, do you have access to good food, fresh fruits and vegetables? So essence of the community very definitely play in one's overall health.
Do you think of something like crime as, I mean, we saw a homicide rate increase last year in Kansas City, Missouri. Do you think that things like that, do you think of that as part of health?
It is. Absolutely it is. And also things around health like infant mortality, immunization rates, many of the socioeconomic factors definitely contribute to the overall health of a community.
Are the most common risks to our health what the same as what the general public tends to think they are?
Usually not. Everyone seems to focus in on, gee, what is my blood pressure numbers? What is my cholesterol? And yet they may not think about, someone who's younger, death from automobile accidents or suicide is actually one of the largest risks to one's health. So it definitely changes over a lifetime.
How do you think that these things all kind of fit together? I mean, something like the risk of suicide as compared with thinking about something like fitness and exercise. I mean, are all of these components of health in some way related, like under some philosophical umbrella even?
Absolutely. And I think that's where you really start to look at your public health sphere and to see what resources are there in the community available, not only for screenings, but also health fairs and things to increase public awareness.
Matt, is there a story from your gym, like a success story that kind of exemplifies maybe how one area of someone's personal health is sort of maybe unexpectedly related to another?
Hundreds. I have a cork board in my office, actually, and every time I get a handwritten note or an email from somebody, it gets put on this cork board, and it's full of stories of people that have been trying to be healthy, like with their best intentions, and have struggled with things like their body image, feelings of self-worth, and constant feelings of failure. And these are people that are getting access to environments that are supportive and really letting them buy into this process. And so now they're able to see these things that they can do. And, you know, if you walk into the gym unable to run a mile, and then you can run a mile, and you can now celebrate that small little success, that's going to carry you way beyond, you know, what most people come to us thinking they want out of their health. So by showing people things that they can do and celebrating their successes, you're able to carry them on along the process. And then you can have conversations about nutrition, being moderate in your drinking and things like that. But people need sort of a wave of success behind them before they're able to kind of push through the more difficult aspects of health.
There was in college someone I was in school with who was in, she was in medical school, and she was participating in a graduate level experiment, and she wanted to hear that she had like a really good heart, and they told her hearts don't work that way. It's either like normal or it's not good. Do you think that there's a misconception there in health, just an achievement type mentality?
Absolutely. And I think that that's something that, again, we need to continue to frame and help educate on.
Well, sadly, our time is up for this conversation, but keep talking about what it means to be healthy and whether we might benefit from a shift in perspective. You can do that on Twitter. We're at KCURCST. Matt Scanlon of CrossFit Memorial Hill Gym, This has been interesting. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
And Michael Munger with us from St. Luke's South Primary Care. I really appreciate your joining us today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
You can listen back to this conversation and subscribe to our podcast at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, segregation is no longer the letter of the law, but it's still an issue in our schools. A look back at the history of busing here in Kansas City with stories from people who were bused to school themselves. Don't miss that tomorrow at 10. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. Special thanks to Alex Smith and the Heartland Health Monitor. I'm Gina Kaufman. That's a wrap. Stay tuned for Up to Date.